My name is Michael McCusker. Yesterday, 22 June, was the 70th anniversary of Operation Barbarossa. Nazi Germany invaded Russia, and perhaps the most titanic land battle ever fought in world history. And ultimately, it presaged the end of World War II and the Allies' victory. Contrary to our own popular opinion, the United States did not win the war. Russia won it, even though, in a sense, we profited more than anybody else ever did. For one reason, the war was not fought in our country. Even though this is the second day, or the third day, I beg your pardon, of summer, and I'm going to read about summer. It's been a very rainy morning, and I got soaked in a squall walking here. But I'm going to read a perennial that I generally read every year. This is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in the entire cosmos and multiple universes. And it's a revision of other times I've read it before. Summer Gold Rush. The silly season is in full avarice. Cash registers from coast to coast and amusement parks in between are playing America's song. Our Oregon and Washington beach towns are emporiums of prosperity, their streets and sands swarming with an annual infestation of sun and fun, hungry protoplasm. Everybody wants a cut of the tourist buck. Tourism attempts to fill the void left by depleted natural resources, whose exploitation built and sustained the local coastal culture until the forests were cut down and the great fish runs decimated by the impetuous greed of white settlers and their descendants. A magnificent land that had thrived for millennia was ravaged in a century. Now, sultans of fun replace loggers and fisher people. They build shopping centers and malls, condominiums, bigger and glitzier motels, restaurants and bars that remove the remaining trees and block ocean views. Cannon Beach, which in an earlier era resisted opportunities to be a second Carmel, has acquiesced in booms like a gold strike town. Seaside mixed its sand with water and remade its graceful downtown into a cement mall. Astoria hustles its bicentennial history to lure tourists from the beach towns. Complaints about tourism are usually whines about discourtesies, inconveniences, and crowds of noisy, fussy, impatient strangers. But sometimes criticisms are registered about the sort of environment that is being imposed upon a previously neglected string of coastal towns and the ambivalence of residents between tourist revenues and environmental quality. The current practices of coastal entrepreneurs are a local symptom of a national malady, that money is all that counts, and anything in the way of making a buck deserves to be deep-sixed. Tourism has a habit of destroying what it seeks, and amidst the commercial glitter and singing cash registers, the real gold is slipping out of our hands. Connie Rose Anderson, who used to live in Cannon Beach, and in 1980 wrote an article for the North Coast Times Eagle, A Short History of Seaside, perceived clearly the changes tourism has wrought. Somewhere behind the pavement, the aluminum-framed, junk-filled windows, the traffic, the pinball machines and snow cone litter, lurks the ghost of a pretty little beach town. A town that welcomed progress as a friend, resisted not at all, and in the short span of a man's lifetime, died under its feet with little more than a whimper. Seaside, whatever it is today, is not a pretty little town, either in physical appearance or character. The Oregon coast wears on its shores a string of such pretty little towns, Cannon Beach, Manzanita, Nehalem, all today facing the same forces and models of thinking which have transformed so many of Oregon's coastal gems into a string of tasteless clunkers. Like Godzilla in a greenhouse, the tourist industry is a powerful force, plowing through the small town's natural environment, leaving in its wake a trail of highway architecture, parking lots, condominiums, mobile home courts, souvenir junk outlets, and the threat of legalized gambling. And the pretty little town loses more than just its physical beauty to the impersonal wasteland of the commercially controlled tourist trap. It loses its small-town energy and character, which are the truest sources of its beauty and grace, and which loss no cosmetic compromise by developers can remedy or replace. And that was Connie Rose Anderson. And that was an article I wrote, Summer Gold Rush. And as it is summer, the coast is going to be blossoming in what a friend of mine calls runamuckas, Winnebagos, and their ilk. I'd like to read something that my friend Matt Love wrote a number of years ago for Hipfish, and this one is called The Straightening. We're going to take a trip down the coast on Highway 101. It starts out with a quote from Oregon Into the Trail, American Guide Series, published 1940. It may be regrettable to see this peaceful, beautiful land transformed into a network of highways clogged with cars and defaced with hot dog stands, the groves littered with tin cans and papers, the hills pockmarked with stumps, and the cities cursed with the slums that seem to accompany industrial progress. We live with speed and the need for the instant. Forget Walt Whitman's invitation to loaf and invite your soul. It must be fast and now, or it's uncool. I reject this like I reject internet access from my refrigerator or downloading instantaneous advice on backpacking Europe from roving wired reporters. Travel guides in print are fine. They induce a slower pace than digital communication, suggest deliberation, and are frequently outdated, so a traveler has to adjust, pass little tests if Chernobyl exploded, the Berlin Wall got raised, or the Aral Sea vanished. I like that. I want a challenge for my mind and heart and the cool gadgetry creating speed, and the instant murders any opportunity for both. That's why when I travel the Oregon coast, I use a 63-year-old guide, but now it's a 71-year-old guide. The book. It was easy to write about Oregon. The state has something that inspires not provincial patriotism, but affection, and that's from the Oregon End of the Trail, American Guide Series. The book, Oregon End of the Trail, appearing in 1940, is part of a larger, unprecedented story of perhaps the most fascinating publishing project in American history. Compiled by an army of unaccredited authors, Oregon End of the Trail was just one of 48 state and three city guidebooks produced by the Federal Writers Project of the Works Progress Administration, WPA, one of President Roosevelt's New Deal agencies. The idea was to put unemployed writers to work by visiting virtually every inhabited place in the country, document its heritage, and then shape the facts and anecdotes into an indispensable travel guide. These were no mere guidebooks cranked out by hacks, however. Studs Terkel, Ralph Ellison, Richard White, Wright, and Saul Bellow were just some of the new talents enlisted to produce the books. Even when originally published 7 decades ago, the guides were instantly recognized to have serious literary and historical merit because of their scope and superior writing. They took the brave editorial line of encouraging Depression-era Americans to hit the road, see their country, and pump discretionary spending into the sick economy. Now the books, collectively known as the American Guide Series, are regarded as classics in American nonfiction writing. On the jacket cover, a blurb declares, Oregon, End of the Trail, quote, presents the story of past and present in panoramic style. It cost $2.50 when initially sold, an astonishing value even then, considering the book is over 500 pages, contains photos and many maps, including a color two-sided fold-out stored ingeniously in a back pocket. The book begins with a precise overview of Oregon history, natural and political, culture, economy, and demographics. The second section features major cities, and part three, titled All Over Oregon, profiles almost 40 automobile tours, and that's a quote. The automobile tours outlined in detail with all the accuracy humanly possible unfolds to resident and visitor alike, that part of the state not immediately visible to the casual observer. It's two or three in the guide that has led me down the old Oregon coast three times. The guide described the region as a series of villages reeking with the smell of salmon oil. Back then, Oregon didn't have a million residents, and Bonneville Dam had just come online. Portland was segregated. A few wolves still roamed the Cascades. The route from Astoria to Brookings leisurely followed Highway 101, or the Roosevelt Military Highway, as it was originally called. Construction on this meandering two-lane road began in 1921. When completed in 1932, it finally enabled travelers to drive all the way down the Oregon coast. It was only then, the guide reports, that along the coast real development began. Their long isolation has given the seaboard towns a certain individuality. According to the guide, Highway 101 followed in part an old Indian trail and thus didn't afford all the postcard views that later the Oregon Highway Commission craved for tourists. Old Highway 101 transported people during the Depression, but not very fast, and it wound around a lot. Clatsop County. Astoria is where two or three starts, and before the term multicultural was coined, the guide describes the city as a place that never lacks the characteristics of the sea that has drawn Finns, Norwegians, and Swedes in such numbers that shop signs in the various languages are commonplace. In 1920, Astoria was the second most populated town in Oregon behind Portland. The salmon canning industry thrived, but a devastating 1922 fire dispersed many people and the city never recovered its former glory. Section A of Tour 3 begins across the rustic two-lane drawbridge over Young's River in East Astoria, with Saddle Mountain presiding in the background. It's not quite as convenient as the zooming modern span, opened in 1965, that crosses the bay further west and is the present-day route of Highway 101. But the old bridge is charmed with considerably more character, and no one expects a driver to hurry over it. That's good, because the deliberate pace in this area provides the traveler a superb opportunity to check out all the clear cuts on private land. These aren't your typical coast range clear cuts executed with utter malice toward coastal watersheds. According to an Associated Press report, an employee of a timber corporation has invented designer clear cuts, which entails using computer modeling to aesthetically ameliorate what a piece of forested ground will look like after it's been leveled. The employee does this by altering straight lines, feathering harsh edges, and creating clumps of trees. And that's a quote. Apparently, this makes the clear cuts look better from key vantage points in nearby cities. After the guide crosses Young's River, it digresses for several pages about the famed Lewis and Clark expedition and quotes liberally from the journals. One entry details the meager first American Christmas in the Pacific Northwest in the winter of 1805, and another passage recounts how Lewis and Clark had to ban unruly Clatsop Indians from their fort after sunset. The guide reports at length about Lewis and Clark, but it doesn't come across as a big deal, unlike the bicentennial commemoration. One aspect of the commemoration connected to the Oregon coast was something called the Confluence Project, which calls for a series of sculptures designed by superstar architect Maya Lin to be erected at several river confluences traversed by Lewis and Clark. One of the confluences chosen is where the Columbia River meets the Pacific Ocean. This is a curious ecological selection, considering how unnatural this confluence is today because of all the dikes, dams, and dredging in the Columbia River watershed. And if anybody remembers, Maya Lin designed the Vietnam Wall. A few miles south of Fort Clatsop, Highway 101 rolls through a now-defunct town called Delmore. Delmore used to host an annual May festival that celebrated the seasonal bloom of Scotch broom, a plant, quote, imported from Scotland for use in broom making and later used to bind the drifting sands of Clatsop Plains, unquote. Now the plant is classified as a noxious weed and convict crews all over the Oregon coast labor to eradicate it. 20 miles from Astoria, the tour passes through Seaside, Oregon's largest seaside resort, which spreads across the Neconicum River, the guide says. Today, this waterway, which qualifies for the state's Water Quality Limited list because of excess bacteria, is riprapped within the city limits and barely visible from the highway because of commercial development. What is visible here is a factory outlet mall. at the Cannon Beach Junction south of Seaside, which is now the slabbed, intimidating intersection of Highway 101 and Highway 26. The tour heads inland for a few miles until it links with the present-day Nequanicum Highway, Highway 53. This curvy southern route enters Tillamook County near Moeller. Ironically, almost as soon as Oregon Into the Trail was published, Highway 101 was reconfigured to course straight down the shore through a tunnel blasted through Arch Cape and a roadway hewn from Neocone Mountain. This improvement marked the first of many to tear up the landscape and reroute the Oregon Coast Highway to afford better views and speed the trip. Tillamook County. When the guide's rider drove Tour 3 in the late 1930s, he took Highway 101 around Arch Cape and Neocone Mountain through a valley. Here he describes loggers clearly visible from the road trimming and topping 200-foot trees with bare slopes, denuded of forest in the background. The denuded is in a quote. The word clear-cut wasn't part of the vocabulary then, but back in 2001, the Oregon Department of Forestry's stewardship, and that's a quote, allowed the thinning of naturally seeded old trees in this area, called God's Valley, in order to, quote, enhance wildlife habitat, unquote. As the route reaches Moeller a bit further down the road, the guide counts another of the many yellow cheese factories in the county and how, quote, many people of Swiss birth or descent operate dairies in the vicinity. They are particularly fond of playing the accordion and yodeling during their leisure hours. A few miles south of Moeller, as the route skirts Nehalem Bay, the guide notes the three fish packing houses nearby. They're all gone. From Nehalem Bay, Tour 3 continues farther south into the heart of Tillamook County's dairy country, called Little Holland by the locals in the 1930s, because of the many diked estuaries that created pastures for milk cows. Native Americans called Tillamook the land of many waters. Five rivers feed into Tillamook Bay, and once they combined to create one of the most productive ecosystems in the world. As the guide reports, just west of the Kilchis River Bridge is frequently inundated during winter rains. It is said that during these floods, some motorists find salmon on their running boards. Now the Tillamook Bay watershed suffers from high fecal bacteria levels, elevated water temperature, increased sediment loads from steep slope logging in the Tillamook State Forest, loss of wetlands, paved over floodplains, and illegal culverts and archaic tide gates that block Andronymous fish passage. To make matters worse, just south of Garibaldi, Highway 101 was relocated straight through a section of the bay's tidal flats. The cumulative result is the ongoing death of wild salmonids and desperate local politics to save local pork barrel salmon hatcheries. Tillamook Bay also happens to be closed a third of the year to shellfish harvest, and it's not because of scarcity. Try manure runoff. In the 1930s and 1940s, heading south from the city of Tillamook for 20 miles, the highway was a slow, narrow, windy inland route. It's even more gloriously slow today behind 40-foot RVs, runamuckas, pulling eight-cylinder vehicles. This section pretty much remains the same today as it did during Roosevelt's presidency, but not without a battle. In the 1960s, the Imperious State Highway Commission, led by Glenn Jackson, wanted to move Highway 101 closer to the beach, straighten it, pave through dairy pastures, permanently split Pacific City, drive pilings into Nestucca Spit, and build a bridge over the entrance to Nestucca Bay. Oregon State Treasurer Bob Straub killed the plan. Passing through a filled section of Nestucca Bay, Highway 101 rolls straight into Neskowin, a place name that means plenty fish in the local Native American language. The guide enthuses about the area's numerous varieties of fish, including the silverside salmon, a term once used for coho, a species now officially listed as threatened in Oregon coast watersheds under the authority of the Endangered Species Act. There's nothing written, however, about a mediocre golf course built in the 1920s from a drained section of Neskowin Marsh. There's also no mention of, because they came later, a flat-roofed motel on a filled estuary that used to be a Native American archaeological site, and a sewage treatment plant armored with riprap in floodplain. Nor, quite obviously, could the guide report that, 70 years after its publication, certain affluent Neskowin residents blocked a potential acquisition of the golf course by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It was an acquisition absolutely critical to improving fish habitat and passage. And I should say that was 60 years after its publication. In 1965, a new alignment of Highway 101 pushed over Cascade Head instead of around it at the southern end of Tillamook County. In the 1940s, the guide's rider had to take the present-day Slab Creek Road east around Cascade Head, crossing into Lincoln County by way of Otis. Taking this 10-mile detour, which winds and car-sickening winds through an experimental forest, meaning it hasn't been clear-cut in the last century, is one of the best ways to recreate the old Highway 101 automobile journey. Of course, a traveler does need about a half hour of extra time and a barf bag for the kids. Lincoln County. According to the guide, the north end of Lincoln County used to be a series of quaint towns distinguished by cottages, Japanese float decorations, and the proximity to Devil's Lake, which the Indians believed that in these waters lived a monster that occasionally rose to the surface to attack men. And that's from the guide. But something was lost in the legend's translation because the monster in North Lincoln County came not to attack men, but the landscape, ecology, Native American sovereignty, and the Caucasian inhabitants' sense of beauty. Today, Devil's Lake is officially listed as water quality limited for excessive pH and chlorophyll A levels and has virtually no native vegetation because thousands of grass carp were dumped there in the 1980s and 1990s to control non-native plants. This area should be part of a massive 1.4 million acre coastal Indian reservation established in 1855, but closed in 1925 after the disaster of allotment. Later, the Siletz tribe, indigenous to the Lincoln County area, was terminated, then restored in 1977 by an act of Congress. Now there's hardly any Siletz land at all near the Oregon coast, except for the Chinook Winds Casino in Lincoln City. What dominates here is motels, fast food restaurants, cheap construction, gas stations, gift shops, pawn shops, car lots, and all other examples of commercial blight championed by the boosting activities of chambers of commerce, a quote, a prescient warning issued by the guide. Former Oregon Governor Mark Hatfield once described this section of Highway 101 as the 20 miserable miles, mocking a Chamber of Commerce slogan. Another governor, Tom McCall, threatened to have the state take over Lincoln County's land use planning because local efforts in the early 1970s were an aesthetic embarrassment and environmental disaster that led to outrages like raw sewage flowing out to the beach. Lincoln City was a model of strip city grotesque, McCall wrote in his autobiography. Leaving present-day Lincoln City, Highway 101 once cruised awkwardly into Kernville and over the Siletz River on a tight bridge. The road continued on narrow strip of elevated land through Siletz Bay's tidal marsh, filled long ago by enterprising pioneers, and that's a capital P, in an act of unmitigated disaster for an estuary. Later, a bigger, straighter, four-lane bridge across the Siletz River was constructed and more material dumped into the estuary to accommodate the expansion. Highway 101 in Oregon is called the Oregon Coast Highway, but with the fill dumped into Siletz, Nestucca, Tillamook, Nehalem, and other bays ad nauseum, it might as well be called the Oregon Coast Filled Estuary Highway. The highway improvement through Siletz Bay, though, is especially egregious. When coupled with the presence of the Salishan Resort development, its golf course, and homes out on the riprap dunes of Siletz Spit, the result is what one veteran Oregon coastal planner described as positively the worst ecological and aesthetic development on the Oregon coast. But it could have been even worse. In the late 1960s, there were plans to fill more sections of the bay to construct an airport and vacation homes. Today, a few people want to dredge it for water skiing. Continuing down Highway 101, the guide approaches Depot Bay, now the site of a massive condo complex called the Resort at Whale Pointe. And that's P-O-I-N-T-E. A world-mark resort, part of Trend West's empire of garish leisure. Tom McCall once coined a phrase to describe what's happened to Depot Bay in recent years, coastal condomania. Whale Pointe is a development that obliterates any non-member's opportunity to see the ocean from here, much less the famous migrating whales. The gentrification also assures that a gritty fishing boat scene, like the one filmed here in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, will never happen again. South of Depot Bay, a curious sign promoting a gated community advertises a private beach, which is supposed to be illegal in Oregon. Someone must have found yet another loophole in Oregon's overrated land use protection laws and bulldozed through there in the name of private property rights, a phrase never once appearing in the 549-page guide. A few miles from Depot Bay is a place ironically known as Otter Crest. Otter Rock looms offshore. The guide reports, "Sea otters, long prized for their glossy fur, formerly abounded in these waters. They're all gone, extirpated in Oregon waters, the subject of expensive reintroduction efforts that all failed." It's near Otter Rock that Highway 101 was improved from the curvy, slow, lean road along the shore, called Otter Crest Loop today. Engineers chose a straighter, fatter route over a slide-prone headland area to the east. Practically every winter since the improvement, the vexed Oregon Department of Transportation has provided full employment for local construction workers. The tour rolls into Newport, where, according to the guide, the U.S. Army wanted to build a fort in 1856. But the best spot happened to be covered by hundreds of Native American burial canoes. As the story goes, after the mediation, the Indians suddenly agreed to the removal of the canoes but refused to take them away themselves. The Army solved the problem by launching the canoes at high tide out to sea, forever separating them from their spiritual resting place. Perhaps multiple episodes of cosmic tribal revenge were exacted for this desecration many years later at Jump Off Joe, a rock named for a local Native American near Newport's Nye Beach. Quote, "From which legend says," the guide reports, "the usual maiden and her lover flung themselves." In 1942, a nearby landslide flung more than a dozen homes into the surf. Then in the early 1980s, the same disaster nearly struck an unfinished controversial condo development in the same slide-prone area. It was ordered razed by the same local authorities who approved it. In Newport, the guide also notes, the view of the Yaquina Bay at sunset when the fishing fleet rides at anchor is particularly attractive. The sunsets still look good, but the fishing fleet has fallen on hard times. Salmon are scarce and the ground fish stocks have nearly been wiped out, leading to new catch restrictions, an economy emergency declaration, federal disaster funds, and welfare programs modeled on the same New Deal policy relief that started the Federal Riders Project and built state parks all down the Oregon coast. And I will stop here and maybe pick it up next week and continue all the way down the Oregon coast. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.